And welcome back to Coast. Let's first introduce Dr. Robert Kuntz to you. Bob is an experimental nuclear physicist with more than 30 years of experience in physics and high technology. Since 2002, he has been doing research in the fields of anti-gravity and free energy, and following Einstein, is currently working on a unified field theory that he hopes will explain the standard model of physics. The theory would employ the electromagnetic interaction as the basis for all known forces. Here's Dr. Bob Kuntz. Hey, Bob, welcome back. How are you?
Hello, George. I'm fine. It's an honor to speak with you again. I've got 7 pages of notes ready to go, so when you're ready, let's do it.
I love it. It's going to be a fascinating program today.
So.
And I'm excited because it's my first time talking to John Hutchison, a self-taught inventor from Canada. He has become known around the world for his remarkable experiments that show physical phenomena that are not explained by conventional physics. And these various phenomena, which have come to be known as the Hutchison effect, include levitation of both massive and non-massive objects that are sometimes metallic, sometimes magnetic, and sometimes non-magnetic. Here's John Hutchison. John, how have you been?
I've been well, George. Real honor to be on the show with you and Bob Kuntz there.
Five years since you've been on Coast to Coast. What have you been doing over these years?
Oh, I'm getting into all kinds of mischief. Mostly television shows and that kind of thing and news media. Working on power cells and more anti-gravity experiments until the mayor got upset with that kind of thing because it was going into other buildings in this area here, and he ordered the fire marshal in, but we made a compromise on everything, and I started more demonstrations after that. So I've been up to a lot of mischievous things.
I got to believe when you were a youngster, you did some of the most incredible experiments. You probably had the neighborhood just going crazy, huh?
Well, yeah, I used to fire cannons off in the backyard. Black powder experiments, lightning bolts, and that kind of stuff. It was all kind of fun. It kind of upset the neighbors.
Well, tell us about the Hutchison effect. I mean, we've got lots of new listeners since you were last on 5 years ago. What is the Hutchison effect?
It's an accidental discovery I made way back in 1979 when I was replicating a lot of Nikola Tesla's machinery, actually to the 18th century standards. And I was playing with this high-voltage equipment, and I started to notice that certain things would happen, like objects would move around by themselves a little bit. At that time, I didn't think anything of it, and I just happened to mention it to another scientist in Vancouver, who then mentioned it to another group, and they started coming around and filming the effects. Then they presented it later on after several viewings by SAIC group in San Diego, Washington State University. They presented it to the U.S. Pentagon just after Ronald Reagan signed the Star Wars contract.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And then Colonel John Alexander and his team came up to witness some of the effects. And after that, I then put it on mainstream media on CTV NewsHour. Did a good demonstration for that network in Canada.
What did people think when they first saw the Hutchison effect literally in motion?
In the news media or the scientists?
In news media first.
Oh, they were all excited. I got fan mail coming in by the ton. It had to be screened to the main television station. That was way back in 1985.
How about the scientists? What happened?
Beg your pardon?
How about the scientists? How did they react?
The scientists were very open-minded and very observant, especially the Los Alamos team and Colonel John Alexander.
Yeah, he's one of the best.
Yeah, he is, and he's appeared with me on several TV shows. And then later on, I did a demonstration for McDonnell Douglas Aerospace Corporation and then some other aerospace companies, and the Canadian Directorship of Scientific Technical Intelligence, Dr. Lauren Kuhn, who then they actually just classified the report. I have no access to the videos or communication to the gentleman, except from that time period. Now it's 1986. That was on orders of Deputy Prime Minister Erik Nielsen, who was at that time Minister of Defense. So
this
letters,
just incredible. All right, and Bob, see if you can explain for us in terms of conventional physics how the Hutchison effect works.
Well, first of all, George, you cannot explain this effect with conventional physics.
You cannot
explain it. This is not conventional physics. This is the Hutchison effect, and let me indicate that this is an extremely sophisticated operation that this young man had going in Canada. I've been doing particle physics research for 40 years and worked at Stanford and Berkeley. I've done Nobel Prizes. Winners. I've been on some very sophisticated experiments, but nothing. This is really something else. This is the most important physics I know of. This is far more important than what they're doing at CERN, in my opinion. Let me just indicate what's going on here. John has three Tesla coils he built himself to 18th or 19th century standards, very sophisticated 1 million volt Tesla coils that he modified so that they wouldn't spark. You know, most Tesla coils, when you light them up, they spark, right? I mean, the sparks fly everywhere.
Well,
so he
sure.
creates the, and then he put a tunable RF system in the primary of the Tesla coils so he could adjust the frequency. And very carefully adjusted the frequencies of these Tesla coils that are not sparking, but they're generating fields. And the fields are creating canceling electromagnetic fields, and that is not understood in terms of modern physics, classical electrodynamics. They do not understand canceling electromagnetic fields. If you ask people what happens when two photons cancel, they'll say nothing. They say it disappears. But that's not true. Two canceling photons goes into the scalar field. It produces scalar effects. And those scalar effects relate to anti-gravity. If you talk to any physicist about anti-gravity, a classical physicist, they'll tell you it's impossible. There's no theory of anti-gravity in classical physics. And, you know, John, listen, he can levitate 70-pound cannonballs without, you know, like using 200 watts of power. And there's no physics theory that provides for that. And so he says he stumbled into this. It was very – that's an understatement. He spent 30 years working on this and modified it slowly over time. And also there was a 1 million volt Van de Graaff electrostatic generator operating in the system too. So this is an extremely sophisticated – this is more sophisticated even than what Tesla did in his experiments, I think. I don't know everything that Tesla did. But, you know, if you talk to any physicist and you ask them what happens when photons cancel, they can't give you an answer. It's not in classical. They say that the answer is zero. It sums to zero, but that's not true. And so this is extremely sophisticated science. This is and very, very, very important. It also relates to, this business with the Philadelphia experiment. Oh, let me just indicate. I'll give you another example here.
Right.
John is able to shred bars of steel, puts it in his apparatus, say a 3-inch thick by 3-inch thick piece of steel, maybe a foot long or 2 feet long, and the thing will turn to jelly or it'll shred. And I have pictures of it on my website. There's no conventional physics that does anything like this. There's no heat involved. In a matter of seconds, it shreds. Or it turns to jelly, or it disappears. This is extremely sophisticated. John is the master of understatement. This man, and as far as stumbling in there, this is no amateur operation. This is John is a very sophisticated scientist, and this business of tuning the primaries of Tesla coils with a very, very, very sophisticated RF generator, high current capability, is beyond most people's understanding. This is very, very sophisticated. This is not an amateur hour operation. As some people would have you believe, with a tiny little effect. This is the most sophisticated piece of apparatus I know of, or apparati, or whatever the plural is, that I know of. And it's extremely important to physics. Classical electrodynamics, classical physics cannot explain this. In my opinion, there's not one scientist in the world that I know of, other than myself, can give you a good answer to what's going on with this system.
John, is your work being duplicated or even stolen, trying to be stolen by other members throughout the world?
There's been some indication from folks at Sandy National Laboratories. They replicated it. York University replicated a tiny part of it. A book was published just some months ago on that. But I haven't really seen any video, really, on it or other information except text.
I had John Searle on the program several months ago. Is this similar to his work as well? I mean, are you both going down a similar path here?
Well, this is totally different. The effects happen from the operating apparatus at a great distance. And noted in the end of 2007 that went into the actual city itself.
Well, let me just indicate that John Searle, let me indicate that the Searle effect, first of all, was replicated at the Russian Academy of Science by two conventional physicists. And the system, it was a 300 kilogram system, weighed about 700 pounds. It generated 7,000 watts. Listen to this now. A system, the Searle effect, it operates on the same kind of principle as John's system, that is canceling electromagnetic waves. But that system generated 7,000 watts of power, self-sustaining on its own, and lost 300 pounds of weight at the same time. It became anti-gravitic and also became a free energy system simultaneously, operating on its own. There was no power, and it levitated somewhat, lost 50% of its weight, and generated 7,000 watts of power at the time. These are conventional physicists at the Russian Academy of Science. Unfortunately, apparently, that is getting suppressed. I don't know if they classified it or what happened, but those people lost access to their apparatus.
Interesting. Okay. I'm going to get into later on all kinds of applications for this incredible technology. And you, Robert, and you, John, can let us know if you think it's being applied either in extraterrestrial craft or whether the Egyptians might have possessed some of it to move blocks at the pyramid. Edward Leeds Scullin down in Coral Castle. The kind of apparatus, I don't want to say machinery, but the kind of apparatus that you need to produce the Hutchison effect, is it? Can it be produced, you know, easily with standard equipment?
I tend to use a lot of old machinery, Navy-type equipment that's really highly engineered mil-spec standards. And anything I build is to mil-spec standards. And when I'm tuning, I'm using micrometers for resonance in the cavities and that kind of thing.
Has anything ever gone awry, John? Anything gone wrong doing this? Is there any downside?
Well, I had a film person got hit by the field, wound up in a hospital in Los Angeles, and at the same time, this field went into the city of New Westminster. And that's when City Hall got upset.
Well, what happens when that happens?
Usually the mayor gets complaints, and other people go to the news media and talk about it.
I mean, what does it do? How does it affect people, their homes?
It makes them dizzy sometimes, and they hear sounds in midair, doors opening up by themselves, some ornaments actually melting on their own. Cold, of course.
Well, and you know, with every good application, then there's always that group that would love to use it for some other purpose. I guess this effect could be used as a weapon, couldn't it?
Well, that was 1983 with Colonel John Alexander and friends. They basically didn't want to be surprised by Russian technology. And then in 2006, I was invited by the U.S. Pentagon after they showed my videos to 400 officers to regroup and work with them. But I respectfully declined because I was doing so many television shows with this thing. And there was talk about it being used in Iraq. I got strange emails from people saying that they were using the Hutchison effect and vaporizing buses and other things like that. So a great weapon, yes.
Let me just say that Colonel Tom Bearden is familiar with the scalar electromagnetic weapons aspects of this kind of system. And apparently the Soviets had these weapons as far as back as, I don't know, 1960 or 1970. In fact, one of Tom Bearden's books, on the front cover, it shows a picture of a scalar electromagnetic weapon producing effects over the skies of California.
Interesting.
That's like 1970, 1975. So the Soviets, that was the Soviets then, and that would be the Russians now. Now, I think they I can't imagine that they would just do not continue with the research, but I've heard that they got a little scared with they had some accidents and the weapons got out of control. You know, if something becomes self-sustaining, what can happen? No one knows. And so I guess they were starting to create earth resonances, and they shut the system down. Maybe they stopped the research. I don't know. You know, the Philadelphia experiment, this, I don't know. Well, I researched that, and I don't know for sure if it happened or not, but John Hutchison's experiments indicate it could have, because John Hutchison is able to make things go invisible. It can shred bars of steel, you know, and as far as danger, there is potential danger with his apparatus. The fields are pretty local, but I guess they become self-sustaining. They can go off on their own, like little bundles of something or other. I don't know, scalar energy, self-sustaining scalar energy. So there is a potential danger with the weapons aspect of it. And I do believe the Russians are probably very advanced to scalar weapons. As far as I know, maybe it's too scary for him. I don't know.
How easy would it be, Bob, for physicists to duplicate what John Hutchison has invented?
Well, you have to be very careful. You can't do this in a hodgepodge fashion. You have to tune things very carefully. You know, you just can't slap things together and say, okay, it doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't work or it does work. You have to spend time, and you have to get the right materials, and you have to get right resonances. And you see, to cancel electromagnetic fields in the right way, you have to have the right frequencies. It's a resonance phenomena, and it's a vacuum fluctuation, and it has to do with the so-called longitudinal component of the electromagnetic wave, which most physicists don't understand. Most physicists use what they call a transverse gauge. They don't even believe in the longitudinal gauge. But if you use the transverse gauge for your theory and you need to use the longitudinal gauge, you see, most physicists use the transverse gauge. These are longitudinal waves, and you have to use the longitudinal wave theory. So it's complicated, and you have to be careful. And, you know, conventional physicists, if they could talk with me or the right people, I think they could replicate it. Certainly, these two scientists at the Russian Academy of Science did that. And, you know, that confirms what John Searle said. John Searle said he had a flying saucer that was flying around. He had a remote control.
Yeah, absolutely. And it kept going. And it never stopped, I guess. It's still going somewhere beyond the solar system now.
Yeah, and my theory says that these things will avoid collisions. Once they get going, they'll either become invisible or they'll just pass right through things and become... They go through something called singularities. In physics, if you can avoid singularities, that means you're avoiding collisions, more or less. So these systems go either avoid something or they just pass right through it and become invisible and go into another dimension. So it's funny. It's as far as space travel goes, it's the best thing you can ever imagine because you don't need any power and you don't run into anything.
Let's talk about the propulsion with both of you when we come back. Both your websites linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And get up to coasttocoastam.com and take a look at the link, but a picture of the 70-pound cannonball that is levitating. Just go take a look at that. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. Robert Koontz and John Hutchison on Coast to Coast AM. We'll talk about the propulsion system, Bob and John, in how it could work in terms of, let's say, a UFO or some kind of applied craft here on this planet. How would it work? Bob, you start.
George, may I interrupt you just for a minute, and we'll come back to the propulsion system. I want to emphasize something. You know, this economy of ours is in terrible shape. We've got a $12 trillion national debt, on and on and on. Free energy. You know, what if we can have all the energy we want without any real cost? You know, that's critical. These Russians replicated the Searle effect at the Russian Academy of Sciences, right? And that's on my website. You can read about it. And that's a free energy process.
Well, Bob, I agree with you there wholeheartedly. I think we should have this. But do you think that those boys who are making so much money on energy, they want to give it away for free? That's the problem.
I don't think so, but let me just indicate. I got my notes here. I want to make really sure that this becomes clear. The production of energy without the burning of any kind of fuel does not necessarily violate the laws of physics. So many physicists keep saying, Michio Kaku is an example. He said investors call him up every day and ask if they should invest in free energy devices, and he says it's all nonsense and they shouldn't do it. But listen, George, if you make negative energy at the same time in equal amounts of the negative energy. If you make positive and negative energy in equal amounts, energy is conserved. So you use the positive energy and throw away the negative energy, and it doesn't violate the laws of physics. I keep telling people this. I'm trying so hard to make it clear, and so many of these Luddites in the physics community are squashing, you know, imagine you spending 10 or 15 years working on a free energy device. You get an investor lined up. He calls Michio Kaku. Michio Kaku says it's impossible. But it's not impossible. These physicists, these Luddites, do not look around. They tell you there are no UFOs. They tell you there are no extraterrestrial visitations. But they don't look at the literature, or they don't research it. They sit in their ivory towers and believe that if extraterrestrials were here, they would come and tell them. Free energy is possible. Let me emphasize again. If you make positive energy at an equal amount to the negative energy, and you use the positive energy, you're okay as long as you shed the negative energy.
What it's going to be, though, Bob, it's going to be suppressed. It's going to be the haves and the have-nots. That's why I'm glad that someone like John Hutchison has developed something like this, and they haven't muffled him yet. But I really think it's going to come down to hiding it for military purposes and definitely not passing it on to the masses so they could use it in their own needs and comforts. They're not going to do that to us.
Well, someday the dam is going to break. And one of the first things that could happen, these conventional physicists who are, people I used to hang around with ought to wake up a little bit. They, you know, and smell the coffee, because it doesn't necessarily violate the laws of physics to produce free energy. It's a zero-point process, George, and you can do it with water. We could power the whole world with water. By pumping the system just right, you can break the water up into hydrogen and oxygen at 0 point. And you shed the negative energy, and you get the positive energy at the same time. Free energy can save us or help our economy. Imagine if the United States became the leader in the world of high technology in free energy. We could change things tremendously. How much do people spend on energy, George?
Oh, too much.
How much do you spend on your car, driving your, gasoline? You know, Stan Meyer had a car that ran on water. It was a zero-point process. It cost you nothing, more or less. And Dr. Thomas Henry Murray had a free energy device, a 50,000-watt generator, tabletop device, 50,000 watts tabletop, and that didn't have anything in it, just coils and capacitors. John Hutchison's familiar with Dr. Murray's work. And Nikola Tesla had a free energy device and patented in 1910.
I know. All right, let's get into some of the propulsion. We'll get back to this area, Bob, because it is important. John, in terms of propulsion, let's say it's in a UFO or it's in one of these triangular-shaped devices that they're seeing all around the planet. How would it work for propulsion? How fast could they go?
I would say unlimited speed. And also, no problems with inertia and turning. There was a proposal given to the U.S. government by the group I was with some years ago for that aspect for micro payload boost, helping out rocket ships and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be the way to go in hyper propulsion, going faster than light.
Silent? Is it relatively silent, or does it make a lot of noise?
These machines are relatively silent because there's a lot of film crews that have filmed the effects in here. Levitating water was something that John Ealer, director of photography, was filming for the History Channel. They didn't show that in that show, Earth Black Holes, but it's very quiet. All you hear is some spark sounds in the other room. I'm at the control panel operating all the different dials and that.
Does the size of the equipment determine the size of the vehicle that needs to be lifted, John?
No, I think that I've lifted up like just under a ton, as well as that was in the one of the labs I had, and here that was filmed by a disclosure project representative, 1,500 pounds. So you're dealing like 70 watts, the lowest power, but doing all kinds of incredible lifting factors.
So let's say in a vehicle, where would you put the device in relation to the rest of the, like a cockpit or something like that?
Well, you could basically get rid of the motor and the transmission systems and put that inside of a car, and then put a shield around it that would be an anti-gravity shield. Then you could simply steer it in all different directions, up or down, or at any speed you want to go.
Let me just indicate here that probably we're talking about cancellation of the long-range electromagnetic effects of the universe. You know, inertia. If you make a right-angle turn or a left-angle turn, you normally experience what they call centrifugal forces or inertial forces. But inertial forces are thought to be associated with the rest of the universe, the stars that, in the universe at far distances. But if the electromagnetic coupling constant is the needed to couple to the long-range forces, and if you cancel that on the craft surface, then you cancel the effects of inertia. So basically, if you can reduce the inertial effects through cancellation on the surface of long-range forces in the universe, you've canceled inertia. So navigation, you can make right-angle turns, no problem, at high speed, because there's no inertia. Also, there's no inertia. If there's no inertia, if the rest mass goes to zero, it doesn't take any energy to move around. You can move as fast as you want.
Well, yeah, that's true, too. That's true, too. Now, what about the people who are in the vehicle when this is becoming anti-gravity? What happens to them?
They don't experience any gravity. They're in their own. They maintain their local space-time environment and don't experience any of the effects. They're just sitting there nice and calm, and they can make a sharp right-angle turn, and they don't experience any inertial effects at all. It's just like you sitting right where you are. Traveling is like sitting at a desk.
And what would allow you to continue to go faster and faster and faster?
Well, if you convert more and more negative, more and more, to stay in the zero point, okay? You're in the zero point system. If you go if you go into subspace or hyperspace, however you want to say it, if you go into hyperspace, you avoid the singularities. The whole universe becomes transparent, and you can move as fast as you want, anywhere you want, and you won't collide with anything. The sun, you can go right through the sun because the sun is in a different hyperspace. You're in a different hyperspace. And so this also has to do with the Lorentz transformations. You know, physicists only know about the Lorentz transformation mostly. That's why they say you can't go faster than the speed of light, because they're all based on the Lorentz transformation and the work of Einstein. There are three other gauge transformations with the Lorentz gauge alone, and they never use those three other gauges, so three other norms, as they're called. And so basically, physicists are very, very myopic. They don't know what's going on with this kind of stuff. They're stuck where Einstein left off. And but these extraterrestrials, they know about it. You know, that's why these physicists say there are no extraterrestrials coming here, because they think you can't go faster than the speed of light. But that's all based on a Minkowski, the so-called Minkowski norm of the Lorentz gauge. And there's other gauges. There are many gauges, all kinds of different gauges. And so you use these other gauges, the universe changes. Space is also much different. It isn't Euclidean. Physicists think the space is Euclidean. It is not Euclidean. We know that Einstein taught us that it's not Euclidean, but they still think it's Euclidean. It's a complex field, a hyperspace. It's a phase space. It's a Hilbert space. It's complicated, George.
Now, as this is evolving, I'm still talking about it in applications of a craft, and we'll get into some other possibilities, including weather modification and weaponry and everything else. Fascinating. But in terms of in a craft, would that also explain, Bob and John, some UFOs that seem to just disappear and then appear again?
Sure.
Okay.
I would say so, too.
Now,
well, basically, when they jump to hyperspace, you know, it's we think that the Star Trek episode was all nonsense, but it isn't nonsense. Basically, if you stay in the zero point and you go to the right gauge, you can disappear. John made all kinds of things disappear. Now, where do they go? And if they lose their inertial mass, how much energy does it take to move something that doesn't weigh anything?
Where do they go, John, when they disappear?
Well, they go somewhere else and reappear somewhere else, too. I've had a lot of those kind of samples do that. I've had other samples where the steel itself is like aging in time, which was analyzed by the Max Planck Institute some years ago. And they're saying that it appears that the steel bar is aging for every day about 10 years ahead in time. And it's slowly crumbling apart. Now, I sent that bar off to my scientific partner, George Hathaway, in Toronto, Canada, who's had these bars and that analyzed extensively and shown to many, many different scientists that written up reports on them. So it's quite interesting. I mean, when working with these kind of fields, like you mentioned the Philadelphia experiment,
yeah, absolutely. You know, old Al Bielek comes on the show every once in a while, and
he's an interesting fellow.
He's one of a kind.
You know, I used to think that Al Bielek was making all that stuff up, but I'm not so sure. You know, it sounds very, 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 very far out. But now that I really have a better understanding of phase-based physics and gauge transformations, I'm not at all sure. And let me also tell you something else now. It's very, very important. You know about the Big Bang Theory, right?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
I may not agree with it, but I know about it.
Well, let me just say this. A friend of mine, Dr. Barry Bruce, a very good theorist in general relativity, a former professor of physics, a fine PhD physicist, did a series of calculations where he tried to explain redshift. You know, when we look out in the universe, we see the light from distant stars is shifted to the red. And right. They think that people think that it's because the universe is expanding. Okay, but my friend did this calculation, and he put in the gravitational effects of the stars, and that causes the light to redshift. So his results indicate that the universe is not expanding, that it's redshift that's due to gravitational redshift, not recessional. The universe apparently is not expanding in Euclidean way, the way people think it is. Instead, George, probably what's happening is that time is expanding. We have time that's coming out all the time, right? I mean, time is always expanding. So if time is expanding as a vector field, then that makes it look like the universe is expanding. But very probably, in my opinion, the universe is infinite and eternal. There never was a Big Bang. There never will be. It always has existed, always will exist, and you can go an infinite distance and you'll find more stars. The universe apparently is the redshift is due to gravitational redshift, not recessional redshift due to an expanding universe. So my results or my friend's results indicate, and I confirmed this with my calculations, it looks like the universe is not expanding. It's expanding in time, but it's not expanding in spatial coordinates.
All right, John, I wanted to get back to what you said, that some objects disappeared and seemed to end up in certain spots. Could you do that at will, or did that just happen?
That started to happen some years ago, random. It was more or less, I had no control over it, George. And then later on, many years later on, in 2006, I was approached by film people down in Hollywood, and they wanted a 13-episode television show with a friend of mine, Ron Melloni, of BAE Systems. We put together 13 episodes. So one of the episodes we were trying to do was the Philadelphia experiment. So So I decided to play around up here on a hot summer day with a toy Navy ship and some water and actually got the little toy Navy ship to do unusual things. The water started levitating. The ship would send sparks off into the air, as well as actually wink in and out of existence. And luckily I videotaped all of that to show the TV people, because we were going to try a full-scale Navy ship, which we would have bought from Crown Assets Disposal
All right. Up
here in Canada. But unfortunately, these people kept us going for a couple of years, and we never got around to the 13 episodes.
I'm just wondering, John, if you could develop some kind of teleportation device that might use some of the same principles for sending people from L.A. to St. Louis instantaneously. Almost like, the Beam Me Up Scotty routine, but... Is that ever going to be possible?
Oh, that's for sure. That's going to be possible. Some of the DOD literature talks about it in there.
Just a minute. John, you teleported the piece of wood into a piece of aluminum.
That's right. Yes, I did. And also sawdust. Also sawdust.
But that's not the same, Robert, as a person.
No, it's not. But it's the principle, George. How do you get a piece of wood inside a block of aluminum?
Yeah.
Without going through the surface.
Well, remember during the Philadelphia experiment, I think it was Al Bielek's brother who talked on the program about seeing people half and half, their bodies in the ship, but like they were melted into it. Remember that?
Yeah. Now, listen, George, I believe that the laws of physics are not laws of physics. They're not fixed. The laws of physics are malleable. You can change the laws of physics. That's what my analysis says. When you change the strength of the electromagnetic coupling constant and a unified field, if the electromagnetic coupling constant is the basis of all fields, and if you can adjust the electromagnetic coupling constant, you can modify the laws of physics. So the laws of physics, this idea that one size fits all for all time, that's not true.
No, I guess not, but that's amazing. Now, when I saw pictures of the USS Eldridge, I saw what looked like huge coils, John Hutchison. So maybe they were trying this, huh?
I would think so. I've seen these kind of coils inside of some of the old destroyers I worked on for the Artificial Reef Society of British Columbia. Gigantic coils, degaussing coils. But I don't think it was for the Philadelphia experiment. I think it was just ordinary radio operations. But with Navy ships, they have...
But, John, you use coils. You use Tesla coils. That's how you produce canceling electromagnetic fields. The Searle effect uses fixed magnets mostly, but it's the same effect. You're canceling magnetic fields. That's what produces this phenomenon mostly. It's also electromagnetic, too, in general, but the big effect is produced with coils. That's why Tesla was so famous. These systems almost always involve either magnets. We don't understand the magnetic field. People think that Einstein explained it, but it's not true.
We don't understand it. Not quite. Let's take this break. We're going to come right back. We're going to talk about how this is being used or can be used as electromagnetic weapons. That's next. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our two special guests, John Hutchison, Robert Kuntz, as we talk about the Hutchison effect. John, let's talk a little bit of Nikola Tesla and how your work, of course, echoed some of the things that he did. We'll also talk about his death ray and what happened there. But how close, finally, once you started to refine your Hutchison effect, how close did it echo what Tesla was doing?
It was echoing quite a bit. I followed most of Tesla's patents to the letter. Actually, I was lucky to find vintage electronic or electrical machinery in various salvage yards here in Vancouver. And I had a great replication of his laboratory. And that's quite amazing, plus the patents and that, too, to follow that through. And it's very interesting because I got to know a gentleman that knew Tesla and had a lot of his diagrams and documents in his home.
Really? The FBI or somebody raided his place after he died, so this guy was lucky that he was able to keep some of those things.
Oh, very much so. Some of this stuff has actually surfaced in the SBIR, DOD contract stuff in my... when I was on the program, which kind of intrigues me. I have it in writing.
How far advanced would you say Tesla was for his time?
Extremely far advanced. He was sort of cut off by J. Pierpont Morgan a bit, but he was pretty advanced. And the whole Star Wars program, or most of it, is based a lot on his findings in that, too.
Yeah, old JP couldn't figure out how he could make money on free energy, right?
Yeah, good old JP Morgan. Yeah, that's
you
right.
Got it.
I know. Yeah.
Bob, let's talk about this in terms of the free energy. Let's spend a little time on that. Then we'll get into the weaponry and the weather modification, too.
Okay.
I agree with you. We should have this now. Except every time I go to the gas pump and I keep seeing these prices fluctuate, and I see the greed and the corruption that's out there. You look at this disaster we had in the Gulf of Mexico over the last couple months. I keep saying to myself, there's no way they're going to take us down the path of free energy or even cleaner energy. Yet they could do it today.
Let me just emphasize something here. You were talking earlier about coils and magnets. The Russian Academy of Science experiment involved rotating magnets. That's the Searle effect. That involved free energy. So that's rotating magnetic magnet, permanent magnets rotating. Then there was Ed Lee Skalman's work has been replicated by a man named Matt Emery, a student at Purdue University, confirmed what Ed Lee Skalman said about holding magnets. And that indicates that Ed Lee Skalman really did know something about the laws of physics that the rest of us don't know something about. And so this guy, Matt Emery at Purdue, created a self-sustaining system that produced power and also maintained a magnetic field. And the physicists at Purdue University, except for one older fella, wouldn't help him.
Well, that's probably true. And, you know, he did say once that he knew the secrets of the pyramids, so maybe he had them. So
well,
I ask
Ed Lee Skalman used rotating magnets. If you go to one of his websites,
you're right.
V magnets, old Ford V magnets with lots of iron. He'd rotate those V, maybe a couple hundred of those magnets on a wheel, and then he had coils that he would place beside the magnets and captured the scalar energy and piped it into those coral blocks and moved it around. It appears. That's my analysis. Now, this has to be done exactly right. Those coils have to be resonantly tuned. You know, that's the thing. You can't just when John Hutchison replicated Tesla's work, he did so down to the letter. You can't just substitute any old materials. You know, for instance, in Tesla's original free energy experiment, he used very special mica capacitors, and they have a resonance that's very special. So you can't just use any old capacitor and any old piece of copper or any old thing. You have to do this right, and you have to know what you're doing.
Well, that is absolutely true. How, John, could he move down there in Coral Castle, or the Egyptians, and we'll get into the Egyptians in a second, but how could someone like Lee Skalman move these huge blocks of stone this
that's
way?
A really fascinating area because looking at his museum there, he's got some ancient radio equipment in there, bits and pieces of it. So maybe he was onto something like this too.
Well, let me just indicate again. He had this rotating system of magnets, and he put the coils right next to the system of magnets. The coils are resonantly tuned to the magnetic field energy. Then they piped the energy out to those coral blocks. That's my analysis. So this is resonant capturing of coils.
What if it was zero-point energy captured by minerals? It's kind of interesting to note, maybe for the Coast audience, that in 1996, December 31, Dr. Franklin E. Meade got accepted a zero-point energy collector that was accepted by the U.S. Patent Office. And I investigated that later on and found in around 2005 that IBM bought up all the patent rights to it. It's a principle using round spheres of barium titanate and cubes of it, which seems to follow the power cell stuff I do a little bit.
That's pretty smart, though, at least, to have that. Have you patented, John, any of your work?
No, I never patented anything. I was advised not to patent it. I've been pretty free about it. I've demonstrated on television and showed many, many people the levitation or the crystal power cell technology. And I have been funded a few times by Japan and Germany. No bad energy there, just the funders had other things to do, and we're still friends to this day.
Are you concerned that someone out there can steal this from you?
No, it's open to the public. I mean, that's how I feel about it, and I hope that people can run with it, to be honest.
You're one of a kind, John. What about, don't you want to profit a little bit from this?
No, just enough to get me by and buy some machine tools and hot dates, you know. One of those things. What the heck, you know.
George, let me interrupt here. I just want to emphasize that I consider this a serious national security issue for a number of reasons. Number one, we've got this a terrible economy. Energy is costing us a tremendous amount. You know, again, we've got a $13 trillion national debt. This year, the deficit is $1.3 trillion. All over this country, their governments are writing IOUs, and we're getting ready. It looks like we're on the Titanic. So this is, and also, let me just emphasize, I have a friend who had an implant removed by Dr. Roger Lear, and I analyzed the results of the laboratory analysis of the implant, and it had non-terrestrial isotope ratios. There was a 2% shift in the borium to beryllium isotope shift ratios that appears to be due to electron capture decay that involved a 90 million year shift in the isotope ratios. So it appears to me that it's possible that we have people, some civilization 90 million years more advanced than us, putting implants in people in the stealth of night. So that's one thing. Okay? Now, that to me is a national security issue. When American scientists are being implanted by apparently extraterrestrials that are, you know, that's a national security issue. So it's economic national security is one thing. And the other thing, you know, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, those people ought to be put on trial for what they're doing. When they have a sighting, let's say an enlisted man, maybe a sergeant or something, or a group of enlisted men, see some of these extraterrestrial spacecraft coming into our weapons laboratories, weapons storage depots, and things like that, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations comes in and tells them they threaten their families and everything. You don't know anything. You didn't see anything, George. Now, listen, you were in Naval Intelligence. I was with the Naval Security Group. Is this any way to conduct themselves? You know, don't people need to know about this? Are they going to suppress this? I'm very, 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 very disturbed about this. This is gravely serious. You know, George, we could wake up on a slave planet. Who knows what they're putting implants in people?
Yeah. This leads us right into this as an electromagnetic weapon in what's out there. I've got to believe, Bob and John, that this kind of technology might have been mastered. You've been doing this for 30 years, John. I'm sure they've been watching you, monitoring you, maybe took some of your thoughts and ideas, experimented with it. They probably had incredible resources behind them to try to find out what they're doing, even beyond the John Alexanders. I got to believe that they've got it in some capacity, but it's a weapon. It's not being used to generate free energy for people. It's a weapon.
Hey, George. Who runs these black projects? These blacker than black extra constitutional projects. Who's in charge? Are they from this planet? We don't know who's involved.
We don't know.
With that.
We don't
know. You're relying on these blacker and black programs, but we don't know who's in those blacker than black programs. Listen, I was an instructor at the National Security Agency, and I was in a compartment like everyone else, and I didn't know what Y was doing. If everything is secret, it doesn't make for so maybe some scientist does know about this in say Los Alamos.
What they wanted you to know, Bob, is that you saw the piece of puzzle that you were working on, but you couldn't see the rest of the puzzle.
That's right.
And that's the way they do it.
That's right. So how are most scientists going to know about this if it's held secret? If it's secret, and also black programs can get shut down. You know, you can have a tremendous, wonderful black project that we could save the world with free energy, and the government, whoever's president, just comes in with an axe, whether it's
A few weeks ago, a Russian scientist said that the droughts in Russia, the calamities on other parts of the planet were being caused by the United States using some kind of electromagnetic weapon. John Hutchison, possible?
Highly possible, yes.
I think it's a false flag. The Russians are the ones that have those scalar electromagnetic weapons, not us. They've had them since 1960 or 70. Dr. Bearden shows on the front cover of one of his books a picture of a Soviet scalar electromagnetic weapon producing a grid pattern.
All right, explain that. Explain the scalar electromagnetic weapon, Bob.
Well, basically, it's a long-range version of what John Hutchison is doing. In a sense, it creates canceling electromagnetic fields in the upper atmosphere, and it is a kind of a coordinate system. And when you get cancellation of the fields, it produces movement in the clouds. It's a long-range weapon that can reach around the world. Also, you can pump the atmosphere. The Earth is like, you've heard of the Schumann resonance, things like that. You can create scale standing waves in the environment, in the atmosphere. So I think that Russian scientist was full of it. I don't think the heart system is doing much. It probably uses some scalar effects, but the Soviets and the Russians are the ones that were big on this 30, 40, 50 years ago. Scale in the United States, physicists don't even know about scalar physics. If you talk to 90% or 100% almost of physicists, they don't know about scalar weapons. The Soviets were far ahead of us. They picked up where Tesla left off. This HARP, everyone worries about HARP. I don't think that does much. But the scalar weapons that the Soviets had, they were blockbusters, and I imagine they still are.
Well,
yes,
you know,
I remember mainstream media reporting some of the effects of cold hole explosions in the air. And radio clouds, that's on the main media, and the Soviet woodpecker.
Yeah, Soviet woodpecker, you can go on the internet, you can hear it. The woodpecker signal.
So, well, do you think they have tested it and that something's gone awry here, causing these severe droughts over there in Russia?
High possibility.
No, George. I've seen standing waves in the atmosphere that I can't explain. Also, what's going on with these contrails, or they call them chemtrails? You know, I can put up with a certain amount of condensation trails, but some of the stuff is totally insane. You know, you look at some of these pictures of these cross grid patterns in the sky. Who's producing these effects? This is not ordinary contrails. There's something going on. Now, I'm not saying it may be something in the additives in the fuel. I don't know, but there's something going on with those. Not all of them are condensation trails. Now, people will tell me, that's nonsense. But if you really look in, George, I'm a fairly good physicist. I've been at this 40 years. I look around. I think about things. Those chemtrails, you look at all, some of them are not produced by ordinary planes doing ordinary things.
No, that's true. There's no doubt about that. And God knows where it'll lead us.
Well, listen, I told you, who's running this these programs, these blacker than black programs? You know, I don't want to get people too worked up, but this is serious. My complaint is that everything always in the United States, there's never a sense of urgency. Never a sense of urgency. Here we are, $12, $13 trillion national debt, $1.3 trillion deficits. Extraterrestrials are implanting our scientists. We've got this crazy business going on with the atmosphere. Our physicists tell us that there's nothing wrong. We know the laws of physics when we don't, and on and on and on. You know, I don't know, George. We got to wake up. We really got to start moving. You know, I tell you, I work 15, 16, sometimes I work 2 or 3 days straight. round the clock, 7 days a week. I haven't been to a movie in 30 years, but I don't see other people. Well, maybe you do. I mean, you work hard. Lots of people do. But we got to get a sense of urgency going here. We can't. This is unsustainable, this whole business that we're in. That's why I'm a little bit hectic or frantic about this.
You don't sound frantic at all, Bob. Not at all. Yeah. Well, what are the Chinese doing about this kind of technology? Do any of you know?
Had a Chinese film crew come here and film. So, they brought their own samples, and it was a block of rubber that turned into a big oily mess on the test target area.
Now, so they're obviously aware of this technology.
Yeah, it was Chinese television. Filmed these strange things happening for quite a while, and then they went off to China. I don't know if the show ever aired, but I did actually videotape them. And the effects that were happening with this block of material that turned into this gooey, oily.
When this first started happening, John, when you saw it finally working, I mean, what did you think?
Oh, what, the Hutchison effect?
Yeah.
I wasn't surprised at all. I thought it was kind of a bit of annoyance. It was kind of funny because my business partners at the time and scientists said, well, you know, John was a real wreck because, you know, he'd be throwing out the metal samples in the garbage because he couldn't use them for machining purposes. So they would talk about this years later, of course, and at that time, I being not a scientist at all or not trying to promote anything, I thought, well, it's just a curious type of high voltage effect.
And Bob, how about you? How did you come across the Hutchison effect? How did you know about John?
Okay, in 2002, I was coming down from Altoona, Pennsylvania, to my home, driving along the highway, and I saw one of these unusual tracks in the sky. I had a camera with me, a bitmap camera, and I took 26 pictures of this the system, and I took it home and blew it up in the computer and analyzed it very carefully, and I found a disc-shaped object, a very clear. As the pictures are on my website, drkunz.com, but a very clear picture of a disc-shaped object moving very slowly. This was at 12 o'clock in the midday, 11 o'clock in the brightest, sunniest day you can ever imagine. This was not a thing in the middle of the night, a glowing ball. This was a disc-shaped object that I photographed in the middle of the day. So what I said to myself is, what's going on? How do these things stay in the air? So I started doing analysis in study of anti-gravitic effects. I studied the work of Townes and Brown. I replicated the Brayfield-Brown effect and got an anti-gravitic effect here in my little lab.
Hold on, Bob. More to come when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM, including we'll chat with John about what it was like levitating a 70-pound cannonball. You can see the picture at coasttocoastam.com. Okay, we got a picture of the 70-pound cannonball, John. Kind of explain for us the levitation method here for it, the anti-gravity experiment.
And that was in the giant lab I had in 1988-87 time period, and it was filmed by Brent, and I got kind of nervous when I saw that thing starting to float up. I mean, I kind of backed away, and because I've seen something that heavy levitating, you know, it could go also into what they call translational movements as well. But luckily, it just hovered there and then found its resting state again.
And, I mean, how high up did it go? Just a few inches?
I'm trying to remember now. I got it on Prime Video, high-definition video.
About a foot.
Some of these are on YouTube too, right? Aren't they?
Yeah, actually, they're my YouTube channel. Yes, I. What I've done is kind of bad because I used a digital ELF to film a television set and then put download it onto YouTube, so the quality is not that great. But yes, it's on YouTube. I'm kind of a YouTube fan character here and uploaded a lot of my bits and pieces on my TV shows. I'm trying to improve the quality for the audience because they complain. I don't blame them because it is kind of, some of them are pretty bad videos, rough and grain and all that kind of thing. But a lot of my footage is sold by Griffin Film Productions as well on the international market.
But, you know, we were talking about the Chinese. We got a fast blast in from Wichita. And James wants to know if the Chinese have this as a weapon, or do you think it's just, as Bob said, the Russians? What do you think, John?
Unknown with China. Really unknown. I mean, the black ops world is full of mysteries, full of leaks. Sometimes I meet black ops people, and they say it's secret. I say, okay, I understand it's secret. I have a friend who investigated the black ops world, Nick Cook of Jane's Defense Weekly, and he wrote a book called The Hunt for Zero Point, and run into some very interesting folks doing interesting experiments.
Have you ever been concerned, John, for your own safety, your life? You know, we saw the tragic deaths of Eugene Malov. That could have been a robbery, probably was, but still a tragedy nonetheless, working on zero-point energy and, you know, cold fusion.
That was very tragic, George. I remember that incident. Very, very tragic. No, I never had any kind of threats. I've had spooks come around pretending there's somebody else and just looking what I'm doing, but no threats or anything. No.
How about you, Bob Koontz?
I've never had an incident of any kind, except once I was in communication with a former Air Force Army officer who was inspecting NATO bunkers for electromagnetic for soundness. And something happened to me as a consequence of that. And also, when I was at Berkeley in 1982, I had something happen. So I would say, yeah, I've had some things that pretty serious things happen to me.
I think so, too. John, of everything
I tend to forget about them, but two very serious incidents. life-threatening.
Let's talk about the Egyptians for just a moment. If they had this technology, where is it, John Hutchison? Where did it go?
That's a good, very good question, George. Probably buried somewhere in some museum somewhere. I heard about this when I was reading a book called Our Haunted Planet. In these museums around the world, they have artifacts that they can't categorize, so they just leave them sitting in the basements of museums. An example would be a piece of stainless steel that is so old that rock has grown around it. So maybe they had technology back then that could levitate these giant blocks of stone and put them in place. I mean, I worked with the Ark of the Covenant. I was approached by Discovery Channel to replicate the Ark of the Covenant. That's a big challenge to me. Can I do it? You know, I like those kind of challenges. And I said, okay, I'll do it.
Let me just indicate here that
It worked.
Well, and hold on for a second. Let me get it. How did you replicate it? Based on the Bible, the biblical?
Based on the Bible's measurements and that. We couldn't afford gold, so we used copper. And we were 6 months into production, and the producers phoned me and said, well, this is a big day, John. Good luck. And I say, yeah, I think I need it. You know, I don't think anything's going to happen, but it did happen. It just seemed to draw in like a giant vacuum cleaner all this energy, converted into electrical energy that shot between the cherubim, causing a giant fireball, destroyed the cherubim.
Yep.
Scared the heck out of the people that owned the metal supermarket, and we even caught entities coming out of the thing, too, which our cameraman cut all that stuff, and you can briefly see them on the one-hour special.
Yeah, I've produced these entities, too, in my lab. I don't necessarily call them entities. It's some sort of entities, self-organizing system that seems to be alive. It's like an ectoplasmic plasma of some kind. I've had a whole lab area filled with it using canceling electromagnetic fields in a large coil.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But you have to do the physics right in this. You know, people think they can slap things together and they get a null result and they say, oh, there's nothing to it. You have to take your time. You know, again, John Hutchison replicated Tesla's work down to the finest detail. He put 50 coats of lacquer or shellac on his coils, things like that. Yeah, this is not something you can just use any old piece of junk and substitute a capacitor. And the materials are very important. You have to use involve sound waves and phonons and resonant frequencies, material science. It's not, you know, you just can't slap it together.
Well, no. It takes a long time. Practice, trial, and error. What's the worst that could happen, John Hutchison, if something goes awry? What if you're in, let's assume you're flying in one of these vehicles that is being propelled by this, and the machinery breaks? What happens?
Oh, it'd be a horrendous mess. If the machinery literally broke, it'd be a horrendous mess. I mean, it would be just incredible. It'd be just vaporized, instant vaporization, I'd say.
Is that possible?
Oh, yeah, it's highly possible. I mean, that high-speed projectiles, if anything goes awry with them, they just vaporize.
So not to be played with at home, is it?
Oh, I always kind of remember when a film crew from National Geographic came here, and the producer's lady producer, was her hair started floating in the air, and everybody stopped filming and saying, John, are we going to be okay? And I said, don't worry about it. It's just a little bit of electrostatic going on here.
I would guess, John, that when people see this in motion and they see it face to face, they're amazed, huh?
Some are. The scientists are. The film crews really are kind of like, oh, well, you know, it's just let's film it, call it a day towards the end of the day, and then put it on television. I think the best producer I had so far to date has been Griffin Productions. Peter Von Puttkamer, he put his heart into making the Beyond Invention TV series.
Well, I guess they have to believe in this, don't they? They have to believe in the project.
Yeah, yeah. And the longest levitation we had was 15 minutes. That was with Rob Simone.
Oh, sure. No, Rob, real well.
Yeah, he was here. And they filmed here for most of the day, and we had a 15-minute levitation.
What did you levitate?
It was an actual can of HGH powder.
Okay.
I was levitating for about 15 minutes, and luckily I caught a bit of it on my lab camera. But this show, who owns the show, is Polar Shift Film Productions. It has not aired yet, so I'm kind of hoping that it'll air soon.
When these objects levitate, do they shake, rattle, and roll, or do they just kind of like hover there?
Some of them will hover. Some of them have a ballistic liftoff, where power is applied continuously and they go right up and hit the ceiling. And sometimes these things will simply wobble around and go off to the side and fall on the floor. So many different types of trajectories with these effects, with water, metals, pieces of machinery, bricks, all kinds of different objects. It's very interesting to watch it.
Let me just indicate that sound waves are often involved in this, too, because you can create canceling electromagnetic waves with sound. Now, this is not sound that you hear. For instance, 400, one of John's important frequencies is around 455 kilohertz, and that's in the high that's a phonon frequency in copper. And so you can get phonons and electrons going together or against one another and create canceling electromagnetic waves there. So phonon excitations in metals and materials is very important for us. And also this weaponry that the Soviets used, they're basically modular. They're creating sound. It's not sound waves that you can hear because it's electromagnetic frequency. It's electromagnetic energy. It's not sound wave energy, but it's at sound wave frequencies.
Okay, now, if you were to build a real small device, you know, let's say maybe the size of, a small little radio, for example, what could that lift, John?
How cool that would be. It would take scientific understanding on how to build something that small for it to work. It's much like the power cells, because they only put out a small amount of energy. But once understood, with serious engineering, you got some unique products for sure. Guaranteed.
It's not easy.
No, it's not easy, that's for sure. I mean,
that's where people get the wrong impression. They think that you can just go, anybody can do this. You have to do it exactly right. Exactly right. Tesla was a perfectionist. John Hutchison, you're a perfectionist.
You
follow Tesla's work exactly.
You have to. You have to follow these engineers' work right to the letter.
Has there been any frustrating moments for you, John?
What side of life, George? I mean, I have always had frustrating moments.
How about the professional side here? This.
Well, we took some samples to the University of British Columbia, and they were very interested in the metal samples until my partner said, well, because they asked how they got like that. We do anti-gravity research, and the professor said, oh, no, we don't touch that, and walked
right
away.
Yeah, it's nonsense. Yeah. Like extraterrestrials, it's all nonsense. That's the American physicist. So many physicists in America are arrogant. We think, so many of us think, or not necessarily myself, but many, many, many American physicists think they know everything. They talk about theories of everything. Well, that's nonsense. 75% of the universe is made up of material, something we don't even know what it is. How, or 95% of the universe. How do we have a theory of everything if we don't even know, have the slightest idea what 95% of the universe is composed of?
Yeah. Well, I remember plunking down on Canadian research and development team with my business partner, another business partner, the free energy machine.
Yeah.
It was putting out 3 volts, 3 amps. The big thing is 55 pounds of these power cells and barium titanate. And they looked at it, they played with it, and said, well, we don't know what to do with it. Why don't you take it to the military?
Of course. Everything goes to the military, doesn't it?
So my partner, Richard, he got quite kind of frustrated with it, and we carried it back out and put it in the trunk of his car. But that's another frustrating moment. You know, it's just like, huh? What's
new with you, John? What are you going to do now? I mean, you've worked on this. You've somewhat perfected it. What's next for you?
Well, there's a lot of interested folks in Germany now that are got part of the lab now and are going to be doing some research with it. I'm invited over there to actually fire it up in Germany. I'm going to be concentrating more on free energy with the power cells because it's got a lot of merits and can give the American people some hope. Also, I hope to go down to the Gulf and work with a journalist on testing frequencies on some waters down there that we already got samples of water up here, and actually she was able to reverse the effects of the water.
Now, let me emphasize that John's power cells don't use any kind of fuel. He has these chemical systems, crystals that he puts together, and there's no you don't charge them up. They run on their own. You initially polarize it, but he can create these cells. He can put a jumper across them, a power cell, for a year or 6 months or 3 days, and come back, take the jumper cable off, and it'll still put out power.
So you don't have to expend energy to make this work, do you?
Not in this case, no. You make the initial mixture, and it is good for a long, long time. Now, the oldest power cell was made in 1993, and it was viewed by George Hathaway and Hal Kudoff. But the power cell...
An engineer and a physicist.
Yeah, I know Hal quite well. And when I came back here some months ago from Minnesota, I found some motors that are over unity. The government engineers sometimes will make over unity motors, and it winds up in surplus, and sometimes I score these things. So I have now these motors that are about 20 pounds each, and I can put a power cell on, and it'll be powering that motor. So it'll be kind of a unique demonstration unit to show the people, and to get some interest going.
Sure.
And
could this be used in the house, John? Would it have applications there?
Yeah, I sure hope so. I've gone over engineers like Charles Bombardier, Hathaway, and many others, on the applications of this, how big it would be, and how we can bring it down in size and that kind of thing. It would be pretty big to power a whole house. But
How about you, Bob? You're kind of a rogue physicist. I mean, how were you looked at because you believe in this kind of technology?
Well, I don't interact much anymore with most mainstream physicists. I have some friends that a physicist across the street who we laugh at a lot of this stuff. For instance, we laugh at the fact that, for instance, Michio Kaku talks about string theory, right? Yes. Well, there's nothing to string theory. Well, it's just a bunch of nonsense. How do you make a spherical, how do you turn a string into a spherical object? I want to know. You can't do it. They said the mass of the electron equals 1. Well, the mass of the electron is the dimensional object. You can't do that. You know, there's so much nonsense in American physics, you wouldn't believe it. They use the transverse gauge to analyze longitudinal effects for the electromagnetic radiation. You know, we think that our physicists are all geniuses. These academic types they know everything. Well, forget it. Some of them are dummies. And believe it or not, PhD theorists, some of them are just dumb.
Sometimes street smart is more important, doesn't it, Bob?
Well, they're arrogant. They think they can do anything. They use the transverse gauge to analyze longitudinal photons. How dumb can that be? You know what I'm saying? The transverse gauge is horizontal, and the other one's vertical. And you're using one system, orthogonal systems, to analyze the other. You know, it goes on and on and on. You don't assume that just because these guys have these degrees and have academic positions that they're really knowledgeable people.
No.
I don't, you know, there's nothing to my opinion, there's nothing to string theory. But, you know, people talk about it like it's the greatest thing in the world. Listen, if you get Michio Kaku on there, he's one of the world's leading experts in string theory. Let me debate him. Get some of these guys on there and let me debate him. I'll debate him. I want to know how you can turn a string into a sphere.
You might scare them away, Bob.
Well, it's topologically inconsistent. The other thing is, we use high school algebra. 99% of these physicists use high school algebra. But high school algebra is often just total nonsense. You can't use high school algebra to analyze Hilbert space quantum physics. You know, you're adding negatives. What's a negative of an electron?
I don't know. That's why I'm talking to you guys. Hold on for just a second. We're talking with John Hutchison, Bob Kutz, about the Hutchison Effect. Their website's linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. And definitely go take a look at that picture of that floating cannonball. It is very, very strange. I'll be back in a moment with your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're going to take your phone calls now with John Hutchison. John, of all the applications here, free energy, weaponry, weather modification, the Hutchison effect, in your opinion, should be used for what? The free energy?
I think for free energy and for peace and propulsion.
Yeah, good for
you.
Not
for war.
Good for you. Of course, they'll probably take it and do whatever they want with it, huh?
That's usually the case with anything, right?
Yep, absolutely. And well, you know, we even see it with, you know, nuclear power. You know, on one hand, it's providing energy. On another, it's not. To
David.
The phones we go. David is in Anchorage, Alaska, and you're on with John Hutchison. Go ahead, David.
Hi, John. I watched your videos years ago, even, on the Internet. You really do some fascinating stuff there. I have a friend who worked with was one of the Inner Circle colleagues of Thomas Townsend Brown, and he was working with anti-gravity, of course, back in the 50s, and then it went black, I guess. You'd call it that, black ops during the 60s. And the highest that my friend's ever flown is 120 miles. Of course, he's just not really a pilot. He's just an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering, how aware are you of how perfected, really, we have this technology right now?
Very good question. I think it could be perfected. I have friends in the black ops community who leaks me information. I have not seen it personally, but I trust these people, and their integrity is pretty high.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot going on in the black ops world. There's free energy devices. There's battery replacing units.
I have other friends that are that do free energy and worked with Thomas Bearden and nervous now, spacing his name, the guy in Santa Barbara before he passed on.
Oh, Santa Barbara. I wonder if I met him. I used to go down there.
Okay. Well, you may have. He's a friend of the science advisor. Gosh, I'm really getting spacey right now.
Oh, that's okay. Is that the
Richard
Pap Benjamin?
De Palma. Yeah, De Palma. Yeah.
Oh, Bruce De Palma or Brian.
Yeah, uh-huh. It was Brian De Palma, I think, is the science. Bruce De Palma is the
okay.
film guy, yeah. So
the end machine, yes. I haven't heard much from that.
Yeah, Bruce De Palma was the physicist.
Yeah.
He was actually a colleague of his working on these machines, and of course these machines are pretty easy to produce. They're not even exotic materials or anything. You don't need fancy magnets. You can produce energy out of stuff that was from the turn of the century. In fact, they did. Tesla was doing it. I mean, it's old technology at this point.
Exactly.
Unlimited amounts of it. Mm-hmm. So
it is old technology, and I do recall watching videos, Bruce De Palma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've seen these machines work myself. So
they're called the end machine.
The end machine works, yes, but the end machine's proof of concept. It's not really a practical machine. They have other machines which, you know, basically, well, they can sell you machines right now that will produce 1,000 kilowatts of power for until the machine wears out.
Mm-hmm.
It's pulling it out of the quantum vacuum or the quantum field. Pulls the energy. No moving parts. Just pulls it right out.
Right. Well, I'm kind of skeptical a lot about those claims, but, you know, it's possible.
Well, are you still coming to Santa Barbara?
I'm sorry?
Are you still heading into California and Santa Barbara?
I go back and forth to L.A. Quite frequently.
I'm going to see if I can get a hold of your website or something and maybe send you an email and get you to see some of this stuff.
Oh,
you don't
sure.
mind. You want to see
mind.
It?
I don't mind at all. Thank you. Appreciate
okay.
it.
All right.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, David.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Up there in Anchorage, Alaska. Next up, we go to Las Vegas, Nevada. Hello, Mark. You're on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Mark.
Hello, George. It's an honor to talk to you. First time, long time.
Thank you.
And Mr. Hutchinson, it is quite an honor. You are an incredible inspiration. And good luck to you. Keeping on. My question was,
mm-hmm.
you were speaking earlier about having a device in a vehicle like a car, and you were talking about shielding it. I was wondering, how do you get the power to whatever drive mechanism, or what type of feel would actually motivate the vehicle, and what would happen with people if they were close to that field?
A very valid question. One would think they'd build in some kind of protection device. If people got close to the field, they'd be repelled or just simply pushed away, or it'd feel like a strong, rubbery type of energy field, which actually I felt that and see some of the experiments here. So that would be more really a more advanced system than what I'm doing now. It'd be all probably solid-state non-moving part technology and powered perhaps by zero-point energy. Would be the ultimate.
This kind of technology, John, how far advanced would you say we are now? If somebody possessed this kind of technology, how far advanced would they be from some other country, let's say?
Well, I think it's pretty advanced. You know, as I mentioned before, I get leaks from friends in the black ops world and that kind of thing. I'm told that's replicated at Sandy National Laboratories, but I have not gone there to see it myself. I'm just told this through a letter or an email.
Why wouldn't they invite you?
I don't know. I mean, a lot of the black ops people, it's so hyper-secretive, you know, that they cannot dare leak it out. And I'm kind of a blabbermouth. I get on television or radio and... You know, if I saw something like that.
I mean, if they said, this is, it's confidential, national defense, you can't say anything, you know, would you still talk?
I have signed non-disclosure agreements with friend Gordon Novell on his back engineering of alien spacecraft, and I respect that. I don't want to talk about it, but because I did sign it. And non-disclosure.
So you would do that?
I try and honor the people's, respect the people's wishes,
sure.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Next up, we go to Raphael, first-time caller. You're on Coast to Coast, State of Washington. Hi, Raphael.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, thank you.
I live in a place where they do a lot of black ops kind of operations. And I've been pulled out of my, I don't know exactly what to call it, my realm of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And everything's changed.
Okay, your realm of reality, like you experience something?
No, it's trees that are grown, buildings that shouldn't be there that are there, buildings that are there that shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
I got yanked out of reality, and I'm married to a person I don't actually know.
Okay. Did you see something there, or seen anything unusual besides?
Oh, there used to be the lights and the sound
mm-hmm.
of Olala, and then all of a sudden, I got yanked out of my reality. I woke up one morning, and
right.
I'm here, and now I'm just confused. I meet people I've never met before in my life, and they swear to God they've known me my entire life.
Well, I can relate a little bit to that. I had a film crew here that had the same kind of thing happen to him when he saw the effects here. I think I mentioned that he wound up in the hospital. Going through a traumatic experience, he was interviewed by also an actor friend of mine and by a scientist, Ken Shoulders, to see what exactly happened to him.
You know, John, with the levitation technique,
mm-hmm.
what is to prevent the object from just, you know, as Searle says, he has had an object, he would make a small flying craft, and it, he said it's gone. He said he has no idea where it is. It just kept going. What is to prevent these objects, the cannonball, for example, from
mm-hmm.
just taking off and just not coming back?
Well, it's kind of like this effect is not that reliable, and sometimes these samples will just fall back down the table, or they just actually, we've had incidences of them going through the ceiling and found up on the upper floors. The other interesting thing, too, we took background radiation measurements of the target area, and we found that within a 75-foot radius, there's no background radiation. So somehow the effects influence radioactivity.
That's amazing. All right, we'll go to Corbin, Kentucky. Preston, it's your turn. Hi, Preston.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you doing tonight?
Good morning. Great.
Hey, I got a quick question about Nikola Tesla's invention there that I believe he called it the Teleforce. What in correspondence with the Hutchinson effect and all that, does it relate to that at all? And my second question is, how does the German experiments on the Die Glocke or the Bell and their electromagnetic propulsion system there, does it have any correspondence with it also?
No, the Nazi Bell kind of thing was liquid mercury being rotated at high speed, as I understand it. When you do that with mercury, it produces high electrostatic energy, and you actually can get burnt by ultraviolet radiation from that kind of experiment. If you take a jar of mercury and shake it in the dark, you can actually see it glow. And if you put it by a radio receiver, you can actually pick it up, the sounds of the mercury. Very interesting experiments, but it didn't work out that well. The Teledyne, that was in relation to communication?
Yes.
Very interesting stuff. I know that Tesla had a spectrum analyzer that used lamp black, believe it or not, that he could pick up radio signals and see the actual signals on a lamp black piece of glass and squiggly lines running along the piece of glass.
John, how perfected was Tesla's death ray?
Oh, that's intriguing stuff. I think it was highly perfected. It brought in two people into my life that knew Tesla, that talked about it, that had documents on it. And later on, I found, well, being a member of the SBIR DOD program, you get sent
mm-hmm.
these solicitations. I've seen Tesla's name appear many times in documents I have here. So it's very close. I mean, particle beam stuff is very real.
He wanted to develop a technique to knock out, for example, any enemy planes in one swoop. Guy was incredible. I mean, way before his time.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing person.
What would you say if you had an opportunity to interview him? What would you say to him?
Oh, boy. That's a loaded question, George.
It is.
It is, yeah. I would have to think about that for a bit, you know. But I would probably spend a lot of time interviewing him, asking him many questions, and probably about his Pierce Arrow car and his 21A vacuum tube system he had in that car.
Huh.
You know, it's just incredible stuff that he did do. And some of the machines I found that were duplicates of what he used at the turn of the century, it was quite amazing what I found in Vancouver.
Are you still working on these devices? Are you perfecting them, or have you slowed down?
No, I have my energy's gone into other things, like the Philadelphia experiment, research into free energy.
Okay.
And machine tool design, a bit of that too, because I covered a lot of ground, and my partner wrote a book on me called Mind Benders, and I read the book and kind of laughed at it. I got to write my own book, George, and get the story straight, you know?
I can't believe you haven't done that already, John.
I got to do it. I'm so lazy, you know? I mean,
I've got the title for you, The Hutchison Effect. That's it.
Well, that's cool. Okay.
For that. See, there's a start for you.
Okay,
let's go to Bob in Los Angeles. You're on with us. Go ahead, Bob. Welcome to the show.
We had a good time tonight.
Yeah.
It's ironic that I introduced John Hutchison in the Coast to Coast with Art Bell, and Art Bell laughed all the way through it when I told him he has a guy named John Hutchison, he could make anti-gravity, he could make things lift, and Art Bell said, yeah, right, he's just laughing. I'd love to play the recording of him. But he sent the information, he booked him, and he's not laughing anymore. So, yeah, interesting. Hey, John, you still live in an apartment?
Oh, yeah, it's still here.
You have to move to the top floor so you don't kill anybody by ripping holes in the floor.
Yeah, it's an unbelievable amount of stuff I have in here.
How did you find him, Bob? How did you find John Hutchison?
Well, I was working for Hard Copy at the time, and Harry Tatt and all that. And I was investigating shows for – I was going to book them for Hard Copy because I was doing a lot of stuff, tabloid stuff. So I was busy at the time with O.J. Simpson doing him. Mm-hmm. And we just booked with him. I told the guys there, I said, let's get Hutchison on our show. And about that time, we're having legal problems, and they just canceled the show because of lawsuits and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
But you're so close to being on Hard Copy. You almost got on.
Yeah, that was in New York, wasn't it?
No. We had a Paramount Studios here in Hollywood.
Oh, okay, in Hollywood, yeah.
You work with my buddies Doug Bruckner and Terry Murphy, right?
Right,
Terry Murphy.
I was booked also for Dan Aykroyd's show on Sci-Fi Channel. It was canceled, too, in New York.
It's sort of weird. It's sort of like the UFO disclosure we had 9/11. Whenever someone tries to book you, something happens. It's weird. But
Wild stuff.
Your experiments are fantastic, and it's amazing. I've done a little research about what you're doing, too, as well, and mm-hmm. I found out that, I don't know if you're familiar with that toy called the Levitron.
And
how that reacts is basically to the positioning of the sun and gravity. So in some of your anti-gravity experiments, if you were to get somebody to do computer program and control your frequencies with the position of the sun, I think you could stabilize anti-gravity effect to keep things stable.
You know, I would agree with you on that. It was kind of suggested some years ago by a German team as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm part German, that's by the way. It's Germans and, you know, Nazi UFOs, right? And you're familiar with that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so, you know, it's really funny. You know, I think if you ever get a chance, get yourself a third-generation night vision scope and look at the sky, and it'll pretty much tell you that we have a space agency already.
Oh, my gosh.
Third gen out there, you could see these things flying around up there.
I have. Good old Russian night vision. I've seen strange things through that.
Yeah, I've actually seen one shoot at another one and take off after it. It's funny.
Yeah, I saw that too, Bob. Grimsley showed it to me, and it is bizarre.
Either we've been invaded by aliens or our government is way more advanced than they've even told us. And I think so, because look at Nazi Germany. I've seen some of the plans from the anti-gravity propulsion systems the Nazis were working on, and they had all the plans there. They had the anti-gravitic, galvo control systems, and they had the three spheres. If you've noticed on most UFO photographs, they have the same engine. If somebody's faking this throughout the years, why on the bottom of the UFOs they have those three half spears out of them? They're using the same propulsion system. They have those coils in it. If you spoke to Bob Lazar at all, have you ever talked to Bob Lazar about his goings at Area 51?
Not I, but I have seen in Austria actual UFO pieces and parts of experimental craft work done in the 40s.
I'd like to get all of you together, John. I mean, great minds, huh? They all say the same thing. They all think alike. Stay with us. We'll come back in just a moment and take final phone calls with John Hutchison in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. And just a second, I'll tell you what's in store tomorrow night as well. And we have a text question in from Sally in Washington who wants to know, John, how does levitation of a massive object differ from the levitation of a non-massive object?
Very good question, and I can't really answer that because we've had things that will float like a piece of foam up to under a ton of stuff floating around for a bit.
Yes, it's got to be unbelievable to watch.
It is unbelievable to watch, and no variations in power.
None.
On the monitors, no.
Just keeps turning.
Just keeps going.
How were you able to avoid the sparks, the problem that Tesla had? How were you able to correct that?
I actually used vacuum tube oscillators for the Tesla coils and tune them just below where they will not arc out. But I use high voltage in interferometers. Just on threshold voltage, but no sparks.
Is the tuning that critical?
Extremely critical.
Was that trial and error for you?
It is trial and error. And after a while, when in around 2000, when I did a show for Fox Television on a levitating UFO, I made the mistake of pulling out all the plugs and turning off all the machines and then taking all the plugs down. So after a few more shows, I just left everything as it didn't turn off any of the machines, just unplugged the main, all the plugs from the main power output.
Okay.
So film crew would come over, I'd just plug everything right into the bus bar, and everything would light up again.
When they came in to film you and videotape you, mm-hmm. were they looking for things, trickery, strings, anything strange?
Oh, always, yes.
Oh, they do?
Oh, yeah. You can't report a story that could be faked. That's not a good thing.
And they go out shaking their heads?
No, they call it a wrap, and they take off back to whatever production company and then put it all together, edit it, and put it on television.
Probably can't wait to do that.
Yeah.
All right, back to the phones we go. Wildcard line, Windsor, California. Hello, Randy. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello? Hey. Yep.
Hey. Hi, John.
Hi.
I'm sorry Bob left. You guys were a great dichotomy. He was so passionate, and you're like mellow.
No, mellow, yellow. I'm really respectful of Dr. Kunz. He's a brilliant scientist and knows what he's doing.
Okay, my question is about Egypt and Giza, the pyramids. I want to bring that back. This is ancient technology, what Tesla discovered. I believe that this is ancient technology. You have aquifers under the pyramids all along the Nile, all the pyramids all along the Nile. The Nile moved.
Right.
And it migrated. And there's some energy there.
There is energy there. I saw some of those incredible tunnels in that. They were excavating a lot of area down there when I was down over in Egypt some years ago.
Yeah. And I wonder, are you doing any research on the aquifers, the power of water under the aquifers? Because the pyramids were not tombs. They did not house the dead. They had
right.
no artwork. They were
right.
machines.
Yeah, they keep finding new discoveries with the pyramids, too. I often wonder if they ever open up those little doors they found in a square tunnel.
They're going to work on that. That's coming. And as Randy probably knows, Christopher Dunn, who was a guest a couple weeks ago, he you know, is convinced that those pyramids were power plants. And, you know, they used them somehow. How do you think the Egyptians got the technology or got the knowledge?
My goodness, what an interesting question. I mean, you look at the hieroglyphics. Some of those hieroglyphics look like circuit diagrams, George. Amazing stuff.
They do.
Yeah. The technology, I got the impression when I was in some of the buildings over there that they actually had machinery in some of these rooms. But where did all the machinery go is a big question mark I hold in my mind, you know.
Like, yep.
Cause
they either buried it or took it away with them.
Might have
somewhere.
Taken it away. Yeah, I mean, have you been to Egypt?
You know, I have not. My father was born there. I have not been there. I'd love to get out there.
Incredible. Incredible place to study the buildings and that.
Let's
really
go to Newport. Let's go to Newport, Rhode Island. It's Brooke's turn on Coast to Coast. Hey, Brooke, go ahead.
Oh, hey, George. Happy belated birthday.
Thank you.
My fellow Gemini.
Absolutely. Very
happy
true.
Birthday, George. I didn't know.
As a matter of fact, John, my birthday was exactly the day when you were on last with Art.
Wow.
June 4th. Back in 2005 for you, but that you were on my birthday.
Cool.
So here we are. But go ahead, Brooke.
Okay, I'm calling in support for your scientist, Bob, as far as weather modification goes, because Russia and China are world powers, but they aren't the only countries involved in weather modification. Oddly enough, the Philippines, where Art lives, has been engaging in weather modification since the 1970s. And there was the reason why I know this is, oddly enough, in the Cindy Adams gossip column in the New York Post, Cindy Adams was working on the Miss Universe contest with her friend Imelda, and the weather was really terrible. And Cindy said, "What are we going to do? What are we going to do?" And Imelda said, "Don't worry, I will have my husband send up the Air Force jets to seed the clouds." And sure enough, the Miss Universe contest had beautiful weather all week.
Wow. And I think did the Chinese not say during the Olympics, "Don't worry, we'll have good weather"?
Yes, I believe that's true also. But another strange thing, George, last fall I saw the chemtrail. We in Rhode Island have been bombarded with chemtrail planes. As a matter of fact, I'm convinced they caused the floods here in the spring. I saw the chemtrail planes to the point where there was a black op jet slowly monitoring the chemtrail planes right underneath them. And now the trails themselves actually form clouds. You can see the trail getting wider and wider and wider and forming a cloud.
Yeah,
when there's hundreds of them out there, I mean, they're X-ing the sky, and there's hundreds of them up there, they will literally change the sky into all clouds from being clear blue.
Very true. I experienced that. Yeah. Even in Austria, that happened.
It's unbelievable. It is unbelievable.
And it's so widespread now, Brooke. It's everywhere. And I can't believe some people still won't admit to the fact that it's happening.
That's true. But one of my neighbors in New York was a gentleman by the name of Eves Smitter. And he was the second husband of Mrs. Henry Luce III. And Eves Smitter told me that he was working on weather modification from the 1950s. And he said one reason he was working on it was because they wanted to solve the drought problems in the Midwest. Now, at that point, they were doing this for good purposes. The question now is, are they?
Good point. Brooke, thank you so much. And John Hutchison, you know, this technology in the right hands could do incredible things. They could probably still make a little money, even if they give us a different energy source. Nobody's asking for it for free, are we?
No. I mean, there's got to be companies that actually make the units.
That's right.
They need to get paid, but
It's interesting that it's a very simplistic technology, the crystal power cells, that folks and friends in Minnesota were able to make really powerful ones. And if everybody could do it, build their own, then you have some freedom.
Could you instruct people on how to build these? How technical do you have to be?
Not that technical. Absolutely not that technical.
Let's go to Ruth in the state of Washington. Hi, Ruth. Go ahead.
Well, hi, George and John. I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed your program, as always, tonight.
Great.
My question for John is, was Nikola Tesla's experiment called the death ray, does John believe that that was possibly the cause for the Tunguska event back in 1905?
There's a high probability, yes. After J. Piermont Morgan cut Tesla's funding, he actually fired up the Wardenclyffe Tower to highest possible conditions.
Wow.
Some speculate that he sent out a energy node right onto the other side there and caused that explosion.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I certainly hope we can find the truth out someday.
I hope so, too. I've known some people that know Tesla, and a lot of his papers did vanish.
I know that the recently there was a publication by the Air Force that indicated by the year, or maybe it was 2018 or something like that, the Air Force will own the weather of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody will. There's no doubt about that, Ruth.
Yeah. Well, thank you so very much, and keep up the good work, George. You have a wonderful program. I've been listening to it for years.
Hey, I'm also a fan of Coast to Coast, too, so I've been listening to it for years and years, too.
You were one of the original guests, I think, John. Huh?
Going back around 2001 or 2 or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Jonathan is in Knoxville, Tennessee, and it's your turn. Hi, Jonathan.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
I just want to tell your guest, have you ever heard of an object it's an egg shape, and it's bronze in color? I've seen this object in 96. It was about 20 yards out and probably 15, 18 feet up in the air, and it made very little noise. This is God's truth. This ain't nobody calling in writing a book or nothing. I mean, me and a friend of mine seen that. It was fantastic.
Was it like a craft, Jonathan?
Yeah. Yeah, I could see structures. It wasn't like it was a lot way off. I mean, it was literally like 20 yards out from us.
Are you convinced, John, that if we're being visited, that they've got this kind of propulsion system?
Oh, they'd have it. Yes, they would, and it would be a very advanced system. I've seen some night vision YouTube videos of these A-shaped craft going through the sky.
Yes, huge.
Really impressive stuff.
Now, when you talk about advanced systems, can this get perfected?
Oh, 100%, yes.
You can.
That's like the early first aircraft or first radio or first computers that eventually got perfected and is still going through perfections. Instead of 100,000 vacuum tubes you have, you carry under your arm like a laptop. It's amazing the acceleration of advancements going on in this day and age.
Well, they're starting to work on technology to allow people to put on shoes and gloves and be like little geckos walking up buildings the size of it. But with one of your devices, they might be able to make a portable one. You just hold it and float to the top.
Well, it is amazing times, George. I mean, there's advances in alternative medicine. I'm into alternative health quite a bit and life extension research.
I got to get you together with Bob Crane from C. Crane, and with your brain and his, maybe you guys can perfect a little device, and who knows where we could go with these things.
Really cool. That'd be fun.
Yeah,
for sure.
Would. Let's go to Spring, Texas. It's Jerry's turn. We'll get you in. Go ahead, Jerry.
Hey, George. Happy birthday. I didn't know it was your birthday today.
It was a couple months ago, but that's okay.
anyway, I got a I got a question. You know, I got a devious mind. I'm always trying to figure out things that I hear on Coast to Coast and Time Together. And I hear all this stuff from coming from the Chinese and all about the tires are going back using more rubber and making the tires smaller and the cushion and everything. I'm just wondering if these people that brought that rubber block over there and seen it deteriorate and wondering about the steel that deteriorated, if they changed the molecular structure of this rubber block and turned and caused it to age to where it started turning into petroleum, and whether they're going to use that to recycle tires, or whether they're going to use it to recycle the rubber, to use the rubber over again and put more stuff in it. Because, you know, tires are made up of almost the same thing as all petroleum is. It's carbon black and the stuff that's been alive before, like the I can't think of the name of it there, the latex or whatever that's in there. But back in 1942, whenever the war started, I was born in 41, it was a big deal. You couldn't buy any red rubber inner tubes anymore because they'd gone to the synthetic rubber.
That's right.
Yeah. And I was just wondering if they came over and used that machine to see what it would do to that rubber, if it actually changed the molecular structure, caused it to deteriorate and turn into a partial petroleum.
I think that's what happened, but they never shared the results with me, and I don't even know if the show aired. I was interviewed as well for that one, but luckily I did tape it myself.
John, we're almost out of time, about a minute to go.
Okay.
Well, if people want some information on what John Hutchison has been working on over these years, what do you recommend? The MySpace?
MySpace / John K. Hutchison, or my YouTube channel, John K. Hutchison 2008.
We've got some links for you on coasttocoastam.com to make it easy for people to find you. Remarkable, John. I've got to tell you, you know, for years I've heard about the Hutchison effect, and it's pretty fascinating for me to talk to you and truly get a better understanding of what this is and what you do.
Thank you, George. It's really nice talking with you and Dr. Kunz tonight. It's real, real enlightening program.
Well, he's passionate. He's passionate about what you do, isn't he?
He's very passionate. He knows this stuff, too.
One of a kind. Thank you very much. John Hutchison, and again, his website is linked up right there at coasttocoastam.com. Fascinating program. One of those classics, huh? For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Roth Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.